during the calibration. But that doesn't mean you can't use it in a non-50 ohm system. Even though your transmission line is 50 ohms, every system is non-50 ohms to some degree if there's any biswar in the system, and every system has got some amount of biswar. You've lived with bergwatt meters a whole lot of time, Howie. WB2HWW, I bet you've had no trouble figuring out what it's telling you. It's a kind of truth. You got it, Howie. KQLAW.
How are you doing, Jack?
After Howie. Go ahead, Howie.
Evening, Dick. I absolutely agree with you, Dick. What I think Hal is misunderstanding is he wants to know, you got a 101 transmitter, you want to know what is the power output, not, you know, I won't say an imaginary output because there's actual power there, because it's summing itself. You're absolutely right, it's a resonant circuit. So if you want me to read 130 watts, that means at that point you had 130 because it's adding, you know, it's in phase, so it adds. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is if you want to know what the actual power output of that transmitter is, you have to go into a 50-ohm W-load. That's what he's saying, Dick. Yes, you can use a watt meter. Your watt meter will tell you a lot. It will tell you what the standing wave ratio is. It'll tell you the performance of your transmission line. And if you're smart enough, you can even know the losses of your transmission line. So using a watt meter, yes, a burned watt meter to get an actual reading. You know what your transmitter is putting out? Yes, you have to be in a pure 50 ohm system. But no, you can use the watt meter in a non 50 ohm system if you want to know what's happening to your equipment.
Yes, I agree with that, Howie. If you really want to know what the power of the transmitter is, then put the burned watt meter right out of the transmitter. And if you properly set the antenna tuner, the transmitter sees a pure 50 ohm load. And put the burned meter, watt meter there, and you'll measure the 100 watts. If your feed line is low enough in loss, in the example I gave, even though the energy is bouncing back and forth and it's losing a little bit of power on each bounce because it's going through the whole length of the transmission line, if the transmission line is low enough in loss, in my example, I use a transmission line that's zero in loss. You measure the 162 watts going forward, 112 watts coming back, the difference is 50 watts. The transmitter in that example was putting out 50 watts. Assuming the antenna tuner was low in loss, assuming the transmission line is low in loss. Oh, very few of us have got that particular combination. It is still telling you a truth. You have set up a resonator when you've got a high biswar on each end of a transmission line. You, by definition, have a resonator. And by the way, that's exactly how you build a cavity resonator. You put a high standing wave ratio on each end of the resonating rod. The resonating rod and the reentrant cavity filter. Let me drop.
One more comment here, please. Something I want to thank. That's the reason why when you tune up a duplexer, you never tune a duplexer up with power. I just want to say that because you're right. When you have a cavity, it's a high biswar, and you have high voltages inside of a cavity, and you're going to put more than a watt or two into a cavity, you can hurt it as you're tuning because you can arc. That's why you run like no more than 10 milliwatts when you duplex them.
Every cavity resonator, if you take a look at it in cross-section, it is a transmission line with a very high standing wave ratio on each end. The usual quarter wave rod reentrant cavity resonator has a dead short circuit at one end and a perfect open circuit on the other end and a piece of transmission line in between. That reentrant rod is the semiconductor of a piece of coax cable. The outer conductor of the cavity resonator is the outer conductor of the coax cable. Every resonator is a transmission line with a high biswar on each end. Even if I built it out of waveguide, the transmission line in that case is waveguide with a short circuit on each end. And then you put in some probes to couple in the signal and take out the signal. So every resonator is a transmission line with high biswar on each end. Your 50 ohm transmission line going between your antenna tuner and your high biswar antenna, it's a transmission line with a high biswar on each end. Even though you didn't know it, let me drop. When you did that, you set up a cavity resonator. Energy is bouncing back and forth. And when it resonates, that's a fancy way of saying all those bounces stay co-phase, in step with each other. They build up to a higher voltage. They build up to a higher current. They build up to a higher energy. They build up to a higher number of watts. flowing forward. Now, some people will say all of those watts pouncing back and forth are reactive power. It's not real. And there we're into a gray zone. To me, it's as real as you can get, because in that transmission line, I can put a very low loss sampling directional coupler. I can sample some of that forward power, 162 watts in my example, going forward on a 50 watt system with a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio. I measure 162 watts forward. I can take a sample of that with a directional coupler. I can take that power out of that directional coupler. I can light a light bulb with it. And the light bulb will light at the brilliance that is proportional to the 162 watts that I've taken a sample of with a known number of decibels of loss in my directional coupler. To me, that's as real as it gets. I can light a light bulb with it. That's real power. As I said, there are people who say, hey, the power is just bouncing back and forth. It's not getting out of that system. I can't get 160 watts out of that system continuously into the antenna. That's true. Therefore, because it's bouncing back and forth, people will call it reactive power. We're into a gray zone there as to whether or not the power measured forward, power measured in reverse, is it real or is it reactive? As I said, we're in a gray zone on that one. I think you want to say some further on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW, and TechMan.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. I just got to go a couple places, but you kind of covered it. But one of the little old wives tales of power meters is that, well, if there's an increase in power, there's going to be a decrease in current. And also, whatever the forward power is and the reflected power, they got to add up to whatever the source is. So, those are the things that get people thinking in that kind of mode. I don't bother to stop and think of, you know, arithmetic is not just simply adding two numbers. There's also the fact that things need to be in phase or out of phase, which changes the way the numbers come together. So, K2RWK, KJ.
On the power factor, WD2HWW. The fact that you're in residence means you have a power factor of zero, but you have a power factor of one, that means you have 100% of power. It's not reactive, Dick. You're absolutely right. Your power factor is one. At residence, your X of C and X of L are canceled, so that's all you have is R left, so you have real power there.
You're right, Howard. And every resonator, everything that can do any filtering, is a resonator. Every resonator has a lot of energy bouncing back and forth within the resonator. Now, some very respected people, a guy named Joel, who runs the Doctor Is In section of the monthly column in QST magazine, he once, a few months ago, said that a bird wattmeter will not read accurately if the system is not a pure 50 ohms. Joel was saying exactly what Hal was saying. There's a lot of people who say that. The instruction manual on the bird watt meter does not say that. It is really telling you a kind of truth if you know how to interpret it. And if the bird watt meter can only be used in a pure 50 ohm system, and if 99% of all the systems out there are not pure 50 ohms, does that mean you can't use a bird watt meter? Of course not. It is telling you a kind of truth. And if the loss in your system, if the transmission line is low enough in loss, and if your antenna tuner is low enough in loss, then you take the forward power, subtract it from the reverse power, that is the power coming out of your transmitter at that time. If the transmitter was set at 50 watts, and I measured 162 watts forward and 112 watts back on the bird watt meter placed between the antenna tuner and the antenna on a very low loss transmission line and a very low loss antenna tuner, it is telling me my transmitter is making 50 watts. It's adding to that system on each cycle, so to speak. Very similar to my finger pushing on my child on the swing is adding a few millijoules on each push, but eventually builds up to a whole lot of forward power and reverse power as she swings back and forth on that swing. That is a resonator. It's a resonator we can sort of understand. It's hard to believe. Let me drop it. It's hard to believe that you didn't know it, but if you've got a reasonably high standing wave ratio antenna and an antenna tuner that's doing its job in the shack and low loss transmission line in between the two, think you've got a transmission system. Yes, you do. didn't know it, you were simultaneously setting up a resonator, and the resonator can have a whole lot of circulating energy that's real energy. The number of joules of energy flowing back and forth can be quantified, and it will be a number that appears to be greater than the energy coming out of your transmitter during each second. Your transmitter, if your transmitter is running 100 watts, it is literally generating 100 joules of energy each second. That's what 100 watts is. 100 joules per second is 100 watts. The transmitter is generating that amount of energy and adding it to the resonator. The resonator can easily have, in this example, 160 watts, 160 joules of energy flowing forward, and 112 joules of energy flowing back on each individual cycle. You're not violating physics when you do that. Every resonator does that. As I said before, the total number of joules of energy of that child on the swing can build up to a very big number after a certain number of cycles of you pushing, because you're doing the pushing in a co-phase manner. You could do the experiment where you push forward at the instant of time she's coming backwards, and you can subtract energy from the system. We don't do it that way, obviously. So we're not violating physics when we do this. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? K2LIW and the TechNet.
Comment, Dick,
what are you, Eric and Howie, and Howie, you're not on. Go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say that we use that very principle in a lot of ways. For example, a tube or transistor operating in Class C only is on 480 degrees. So we use the energy that's stored in the tank circuit to give us that over 180 degrees. Grant you were draining it at the same time, but it's all the same thing as the resonator. It's used in other types of circuits.
Flywheel action.
It's beautiful flywheel action. A flywheel, I can have a push rod going near the center of the shaft of the flywheel, and so that's a very low and peak point tap, so to speak, and my piston is pushing on that, and eventually the flywheel builds up a whole lot of energy. Even though my piston is only making 1 joule on each push, I can easily have 100 joules of rotary energy in that flywheel. I'm not violating physics here. It took me at least 100 cycles to do that. I can build up energy in the flywheel. I can build up energy in my child swinging back and forth on the swing. I can build up energy in my LC filter network that's doing resonating, and so on. Flywheel action, resonating, Q of resonator, center frequency divided by bandwidth is Q. The whole reason you use a resonator is because it favors some particular frequency and rejects all others. That's the filter function. Eric is giving us an example of where the flywheel function, your Class C transmitter, only conducts 70% of the cycle, 70 degrees of the 360 degrees is all it's conducting. And it's the flywheel action of the tank circuit, your pi output tank circuit, that carries you through and makes this beautiful sine wave, even though you're putting in very nonlinear spikes of energy out of that Class C tube. You want to say something further on this, Howie? Go ahead, Howie, K2LIW. Wait for the beeps.
I think it was Simon. Professor Simon, we did an experiment in the lab. We took a watt meter. I don't remember if it was a bird, but it was a watt meter. 50 ohms W load, and then into, let's say, 100 ohms, 2 to 1 SWR, we had different ones, and the exact same thing. You subtract the forward power from the reflected power, and that difference is the actual power of the transmitter. So, the watt meter is going to read incorrectly, but you have to know how to read that. It's not reading it correctly, it's actually reading it, but you have to know how to interpret it. If you look at the mathematics in the Bird manual, if I remember the little, was it a blue book or a white book, it gives you all that math, and if you follow that math, all you got to do is subtract the forward power from the reflected power, and that difference is the actual power that the transmitter is going to work. Anywhere along the line, it's got to equal up to the actual power of the transmitter.
Yeah, I agree with you, Howie. You got to be a little bit careful how you interpret the results. A naive person, and Eric recognized, going to get you, a naive person might say, hey, I'm reading 130 watts forward on the bird watt meter after the antenna tuner, and I know the transmitter can only make 100 watts. Something's wrong. I don't believe it. It is telling you the truth. You got to be a little bit careful how you interpret it. the way you interpret resonant energy and the way you interpret non-resonant energy are a little bit different. By definition, anything that resonates has energy bouncing back and forth. That's really what resonance means. And you've adjusted the length of the line, the phase angles and whatever, so that each individual bounce, co-phase, in step, with the power coming out of the transmitter. That's what resonance means. You've carefully adjusted the tuning to resonate it. Now each individual...
Repeater, time out.
Now each one of those little individual bounces is exactly in step with the power coming out of the transmitter. Very similar to you pushing your finger on your child on the swing. You're pushing forward when the child is going forward. You're doing it in resonance. You're doing it in co-phase manner, in a power, in an energy-adding phase angle, so to speak. And you can add energy if you do it enough cycles. That's where all this filtering comes from. It turns out every antenna we use that is a so-called standing wave structure. You've got a class of antennas called traveling wave, which really means rhombic or beverage. They've got a great big terminating resistor on it. But the majority of our antennas, they are a resonator. That dipole, that driven element of your Yagi, or the dipole that you're using, has energy bouncing back and forth in it, even though you think it's got a 73-ohm resistive impedance input. Within the antenna itself, energy is bouncing back and forth. It's required to do that in order to radiate. You resonate first, and you can radiate. When you resonate, you set up all the energy bouncing back and forth to be in phase, in step, with the energy coming out of the transmitter, and you build up a hell of a lot more current somewhere in the antenna. That's what resonance does for you. Let me drop. And that hell of a lot more current, by definition, makes a hell of a lot more magnetic field in that area, cyclic RF magnetic field. And from one point of view, from one philosophy of transmitting signals into space, it's that cyclic magnetic field that begins the radiation process. You take apart any of your mini-net programs, your HFSS programs, your CST microwave studio programs, any of your MATLAB programs, you take apart any of those programs that analyze an antenna pattern. What are they really doing? They're breaking your radiating element into a bunch of segments. They're calculating the amount of current in each one of those segments. They're adding up the current, the magnetic field that creates in each one of those segments. They add it all up at some particular point in space, and that generates the pattern. It's the current magnification that makes a magnetic magnification that does the radiating process. There's a whole philosophy that will support that method of analysis, and that's the way a very large number of antenna analyzing programs operate. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that in this discussion that what is a bird watch is essentially a directional coupling. The output is rectified, and it is then sent to a meter. And when it's calibrated to read X amount of energy flowing across that line to make the needle point in one specific place. And it doesn't care what the impedance is of what that line is connected to. It just knows that it's reading X amount of energy radiating from that line. Period. The actual readings that you get off a well-calibrated bird watt meter is accurate. It doesn't matter what the impedance is. The other thing that I wanted to say is, like, broadcast antennas, you know, make cavities that are, like, shears because of huge amounts of power. But the reality is, even the best broadcast antennas, you'll find bit-wise on your frequency that runs from, like, 1.079 to 1.06 something across your bandpass. These are well-crafted, carefully tuned antennas. You ain't never going to see one-to-one, period.
Okay, you said some magic words, Eric. It is a pure directional coupler. That slug itself is the directional coupler. It's got a detector built into it. It's got a termination built into it. That's why you got to be a little bit careful on how you use it. And it rectifies that voltage that the detector on that directional coupler inside the slug picks up. And that energy that it samples and rectifies moves the meter. That's it's real power, if you know what I mean. The bird watt meter itself, inside the bird watt meter is a beautiful airline of exactly 50 ohms. It is a 6-inch length of 50 ohm coaxial cable with whatever connector you like on the right side and whatever connector you like on the left side. It is a length of 50 ohm line. And it is reading accurately how much energy is flowing on that piece of 50 ohm line. Let me drop. Lots of people will say that if I take that 50 ohm Bird Model 43A watt meter and put it in the middle of a piece of 75 ohm cable, that I cannot use it that way. The answer is you can if you're smart enough. If I know I've got X number of wavelengths of 75 ohm line on the right-hand side going to an antenna, and I got some amount of 50 ohm cable on the left-hand side going to a transmitter, and I got the bird watt meter in between, if I'm smart enough with coaxial cable analysis, I can figure out exactly what's going on. Yes, at the output end of the bird watt meter, the 50 ohm line on the bird watt meter is looking into a 75 ohm transmission line. At that exact location, I've got a 1.4 to 1 standing wave ratio. So that sum of the forward and reverse energy that my bird reads is because of that interface. That's not the end of the world. It's not going to explode. You got to be a little bit more careful on how you rate the exact number of watts you read, but if you're smart enough to analyze the fact that I've got an X number of wavelengths of 75 ohm line going to an antenna on the right side, and I've got 50 ohm cable on the left side, that is an analyzable condition. It is still telling you how many watts is flowing on that piece of 50 ohm line that's inside the watt meter. That's valuable information. It's not a lie. It's not going to explode. There are people who think if you put a 50 ohm bird watt meter with a 75 ohm system, that the whole world comes to an end. There are people who believe that. You gotta be a little bit careful, but that is an analyzable situation. It is not rocket science. It's a little bit more complicated. If you're smart enough, let me drop. You can build a relatively simple equation into your handheld computer where you tell it how many wavelengths of line I've got at 75 ohms, how many wavelengths of line I got at 50 ohms, and if I connect the two directly together and I look at the input end, what impedance will I see? That's a rather, you'd be amazed how easy. It's an equation with about four terms. It's got four terms, two terms in the numerator and two terms in the denominator, and that equation will tell you exactly what impedance you're going to see, resistive component and reactive component. It's very analyzable. Or if you're the kind of person who fell in love with a Smith chart, that is an analyzable situation on a Smith chart. And I'll admit it's a little bit more complicated than what the average amateur gets into. But it's not the end of the world just because you've done that. The bird watt meter can do that, and it's not going to explode. There are people who will scream up and down saying, you cannot do that. Yes, I can. If I'm smart enough, I can do that. Anyway, any further comments on all of the above, KQRIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, I have a question for you.
Eric, and how, I mean, and Wes and Meadows. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I wanted to point out two things. I'll show you a piece of 6-inch diameter coax, or 8-inch diameter coax, where it's got one center conductor that's 1 inch around, and another center conductor that's 3/4 inches around. You can figure that out. I'll give you the answer to that in a minute. But one of the things that a lot of people forget is that, well, we'll put a 50-ohm load on the end of it. If you look at a 50-ohm load to a veteran network analyzer, and you look at the Smith chart, you'll find that many loads have different actual resistive and reactive impedances. For example, a load that's great at 14 megahertz where the dot in the Smith chart is just about damn dead center. And you try that load at, say, 50 megahertz, you know, the dot's in the lower quadrant of the Smith chart. So there's a lot of variables that people completely forget about. KQRIW, KQRIW.
Is that true? We recently bought a whole bunch of SMA terminations from Mini Circuits, and they sell both an inexpensive SMA termination, which I think is rated for better than 20 dB of reflection coefficient, and they sell a very high quality one for more bucks at 40. We bought a whole bunch of the 20 jobs, and we put them on a well-calibrated network analyzer at 915 megahertz, and you'd be amazed how many of them read 30. 30 dB, which is a very good number. In other words, if I put power into what's supposed to be a 50 ohm load, and not 50, it's 50.5, so to speak, I might get a reflection coefficient that's 30 dB down, very high in quality. So with a good Smith chart, we either measure how close it is to the center, or you measure reflected energy in S11, reflected, it's called reflected voltage characteristic, or reflected voltage ratio. And you can convert that into volts if you like, convert it into decibels. And so a very high quality load, the signal reflecting off that load is going to be 30, 40, 50 dB down. I own a very precision made waveguide directional coupler, which has a directivity, in other words, how well it senses forward power versus reverse power, is more than 50 decibels of reflectivity. In other words, it can easily resolve a forward power versus reverse power ratio of 100,000 to 1. That's what 50 dB is. 100,000 to 1 in power, and it can resolve that. And if you look into that piece of waveguide, this is something that's 8 ounces in weight, and it's got some very fancy waveguide holes along the center, along the length of that waveguide. How in the world did some guy at Singer Electronics, before we had vector network analyzers, let me drop it. Some little old guy with a slide rule in 1950, roughly, maybe 1960, he built this thing. How did he know where to put all of these elliptical-shaped holes in the side of the waveguide in order to make a co-directional coupler? How did he know how to do that with such high quality? It's got more than 50 dB of directivity between 8.4 and 12.4 gigahertz inclusive. Put that directional coupler into a feed horn with a signal generator, and you aim it around the room. That becomes a CW radar. It can easily resolve the difference between the signal going out of the horn versus the signal reflecting from the room coming back into the horn. You wave that around the room and you watch it on a spectrum analyzer. What a beautiful piece of passive radar, CW radar equipment. And there are ways of making very high quality transmission lines, terminations, directional couplers, if you're smart enough. But putting 50 ohm cable in a 70 ohm system, or 70 ohm cable in a 50 ohm system, you are listening to a piece of 70 ohm cable right now. Let me drop. This 50 ohm transmitter, Kenwood TS711A, comes out with a 50 ohm cable, goes through my wall, joins a piece of hardline, because I got it so cheaply, 70 ohm TAV. CATV hardline, 70 ohm hardline, goes up the tower and gets connected to the 50 ohm antenna you're listening to. How did I get away with that? I make the joke that I put a piece of paper tape alongside of the 70 ohm cable, and I wrote 50 ohms on the piece of cable, on that piece of tape. I made sure the transmitter only saw that label, if you know what I mean. A 70 ohm cable is very low in loss, and a 50 ohm system works like a charm. And it doesn't explode. I guess it was West that I want to make a further comment. Go ahead, West, K2RIW.
No,
Dick, I enjoyed the conversation, and I completely agree with you what you're saying during the course of this conversation. However, you have mentioned different systems, the mechanical system, with the twins, whatsoever. But you said few words, there is nothing, you cannot have something for nothing. And I completely disagree with you. I mean, there are plenty of examples of having something of nothing or something of not much. The only question is how efficient it is. I have a question for you. Can you think about two examples of having something for nothing or something for not much, which would be the greater power towards the energy that greater energy utilized towards the energy that you deliver to it? Let me drop. Could you give me two examples of it in any system? And to actually,
every resonator, by definition, has stored energy. The stored energy per cycle versus the energy dissipated per cycle is defined as the Q of that resonator, its quality factor. So every resonator, whether it be a swing, a flywheel, a pi output tank network, or your high Viswar cable with high vis wire on each end of it, your transmission line. Every one of those has stored energy that's greater than the energy dissipated per cycle or the energy that you're supplying per cycle. Stored energy for a very brief period of time. You can drain that energy out of there. I might have a 100 watt transmitter feeding a resonator. The resonator might have 160 watts bouncing back and forth.
Gravity that was constantly giving you a work
done instead of you, and you just made an impulse. That's the one. And the second one...
Stop right there. Stop right there. There's a huge language problem. You're on a different subject. We are not understanding what you're saying. And you seem to be on a different subject. Please stop doing that. Who is the next person who had to make a comment on this? Go ahead, Eric.
No, I just wanted to make a comment about what Howie says in terms of two duplexes. You need, if you got a duplex and it's got, so say, 70 or 80 dB of isolation, you're going to have to start with something that's above the level of the instrument that you're using to make the measurement. So a really good duplex that's got 80, 90 dB of isolation, given that the noise floor of most spectrum analyzers runs in the 70 and 80 dB range, means you're going to have to start with at least 10 dBm. And if you really want to push it, you can do 20 dBm. That's kind of pushing it, but you've got to get it up there enough so that you can actually make the measurement, find the place where you're making the null on the other frequency.
Hold on. You use a spectrum analyzer, but a S11, that type of a thing. I can use an analyzer, or I can use a network analyzer. And if I use a network analyzer, I'm going to be able to have a delay floor down to about 120, 130 dB. All that I'm saying, you don't want to run 100 watts or 50 watts into a duplexer. You're going to screw it up. Run 100 milliwatts or 1 watt to do it, Aaron.
Yeah, any of these high Q cavity resonators, not too different from a Pi output network. If you start doing the tuning at very high power level, you can easily arc it over, in some cases do damage. When you're adjusting the Pi output network, you really should start off at a lower amount of power and make sure that the C2 capacitor, the loading capacitor, is open more than it should be. Start off with heavy loading, because you can easily make the mistake of having extremely light loading, the C2 capacitor too tightly closed, so to speak, too high a capacitor.
Repeater, time out.
Turn off the timer in a sense.
You can easily have the loading set too light, and you can arc over a Pi output network. Happened to many people. In the case of tuning your cavity resonators for a duplexer, if you were doing it at the 100 watt level, and if you don't have the input loading and the output loading of that particular cavity resonator, if you don't have that ratio set right, you can easily arc that thing over and maybe do damage. So when it comes to very high Q resonators, which are capable of building up a whole lot of resonant energy beyond the specification, so to speak, because you've got it improperly loaded, you can do damage. So therefore, to do all of this tuning at, say, the 100 milliwatt or the 10 milliwatt level is a hell of a lot smarter. By the same token, your Pi output network, you want to make sure it's heavily enough loaded while you're doing the setting up of that Pi network tube-type transmitter. And it may be an equivalent thing if we had tuning controls on our solid-state transmitter where we could do damage. And maybe that's the main reason why many of our solid-state transmitters don't give you those tuning controls for fear that you would misuse them. So any of these filter-like networks, got to be a little bit careful about damaging them with high power if you don't have them first set up correctly before you hit them with high power. That's what Howie is saying. That's what Eric is saying. And highly agreeing with these guys. We've all heard examples of people doing damage because they did not do that correctly. K2LIW listening.
Show you 60 kilowatts, what it can do.
Well, I'll bet you don't tune that at the 60 kilowatt level the first time, do you, Eric?
No way, Jose, but there are people watching pictures of stuff that after people who shouldn't be doing what they're doing have done.
I think you're telling me that they're capable of producing quite a few thousand dollars worth of damage. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, well, considering a section of line, maybe, you know, 100 or 1,000 bucks, and you got all these nice Teflon little suspenders inside, so they take out about 6 sections of that, maybe 20 feet long. Yeah, I kept it in there.
So, John, getting back to the original discussion, where this submitter to you as a college professor or a high school physics professor, it doesn't matter. Who says you can't get something for nothing. To a degree, he's right. You cannot do it continuously. If you've got a 100-watt transmitter and you read 160 watts forward on your bird watt meter on that transmission line, in between these two resonators, one of them is the antenna tuner, the other one is the high viswire antenna, yes, you can read a greater amount of energy there, greater than 100 watts. It's real, but it's reflective energy, it is resonant energy, it's bouncing back and forth, it's stored power, so to it's got a certain amount of Q, a calculatable amount of Q, quality factor, as a resonator. And one of the six definitions of Q is energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Another one is voltage rise at resonance. Another one is current rise at resonance. Another one is center frequency divided by bandwidth. Another one is the rise time or fall time of the resonator. Another one is DF, in other words, the rate of change of phase with the rate of change of frequency. There's six different, there are six different definitions of Q. And you think you have made six different measurements. Well, you've used six different techniques for defining the exact same phenomenon. Every resonator has stored energy bouncing back and forth. The majority of RF resonators are a piece of transmission line with a high standing wave ratio on each end, usually a short end or open on each end, so that essentially all of the energy is reflecting back and forth. That's what a resonator does. When it resonates, energy is bouncing back and forth. You could say that's the definition of resonance, that all the energy is bouncing back and forth, staying co-phase, staying in step on each cycle with the energy being injected. That's one of the definitions of resonance. And so you think you've made six different measurements when you've made the Q measurement those six different ways. It's the exact same phenomena, just different ways of sensing it. Exact same circuit, if you know what I mean. And all of those beautiful properties, voltage rise, current rise, and so on, bandwidth, and energy stored and per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle, rate of change of phase versus frequency. These are the desirable characteristics of a resonator. That's what Q is measuring for you. What is the quality of that resonator? That's why it's called Q, quality factor. Very valuable concept. Not easily to explain the first time. You've got to stick with it for a while. So we're not getting something for nothing. There's no free lunch here. You cannot get that excess energy out of there for a long period of time. You can do it for a microsecond. But it's not an infinite amount of stored energy unless you've got infinite Q. Let me drop. The highest Q I know of is there's a very precisely made kind of quartz resonator, crystal quartz resonator, in a vacuum container, very carefully mounted, which has a Q that's close to 1 million. That means the stored energy per cycle is a million times higher than the energy dissipated per cycle. The Q of a million means that if it was a 10 megacycle resonator, it would have a bandwidth of 10 hertz out of 10 megahertz. That's what a million to one is. It's possible to make a Q that high. That's a purely passive device as a resonator. Piece of quartz. Piezoelectric resonator, very carefully mounted in a vacuum environment. You can make Q higher than a million if you're willing to use amplification, a feedback network, an oscillator, so to speak. But is it real? Because you're adding energy by way of the amplifier you put in there. Not everybody will accept that. So Q of a million is about the highest. The cavity resonators we use for our duplexing filters for our repeaters. Probably, let me drop. I don't know the exact number, but they probably have a Q of a few thousand. An inductor and a capacitor made real carefully can easily have a Q of 500. Many of the resonators that we use have a Q of 100. My dipole, every 80-meter dipole at a reasonable altitude, has a Q of 10. The amount of energy stored in that dipole is 10 times higher, bouncing back and forth on that piece of wire, than the energy you're putting in. You measure the bandwidth of your dipole versus the center frequency, and you'll find out it's got this roughly 10 to 1 ratio. Maybe it's 12 to 1. So everything that we use as an antenna, with rare exception, has resonance phenomena, has energy. energy bouncing back and forth has a measurable amount of Q. Every filter we've ever used has got every one of those circuits that's doing the resonating and tuning has a finite amount of Q that you can evaluate as to how good it is, how good the filter is, how to make it better, and so on. It's a very valuable concept, resonant energy, and the resonators. It's a very valuable concept to know about, and not well taught, in my opinion. A hell of a lot of guys walk out of that electrical engineering school not having a warm, fuzzy feeling as to what this all means. The majority of them walked out of the school not even quite understanding what an antenna is. And as I've given you guys an example before, let me drop it. Essentially, every single product that Airborne Instruments Laboratory made during its 50 years of its history was a radio product. Transmitters, receivers, jammers, and radars, and rotary joints, and so on. Surveillance, reconnaissance. Every one of those products, per se, was RF. Therefore, you hired more than 1,000 RF engineers in order to run that place. And at the height of their success, highly qualified, carefully chosen RF engineers, the best they ever had for a short period of time is 30 of those engineers who had a reasonably good understanding of antennas, and they worked in the antenna development department. 30 engineers out of 1,000 or 1,200, that's like 2.5%. In a company which needs antennas like they're going out of style, only 2.5% of the highly qualified, highly selected engineers had a warm, fuzzy feeling about antennas. And of all the people I've ever interviewed for a position at that company or one other company, and I asked them, of all the courses you've taken in college, which course gave you the most amount of trouble? About half of them say, that damn electrical, that damn Maxwell's equation, that fields and wave course. That course that contains a whole lot of memorization of matrix equations. I never figured out what the hell was going on in there, is what they basically say. I don't really know what they're doing. And I told you, I found one person who liked that course. And she happened to be a math major and didn't know what it all meant. So I know there's a huge amount of improvement. Every radio circuit needs antennas. From my point of view, let me drop it. In our schools, we're doing a very poor job of teaching the art and science of antenna engineering and the understanding of antennas. We're doing a very poor job. If you want an antenna engineer, you better hire a ham radio operator. He's the only guy that's got the hands-on experience. He's done it with his own hands. Or you hire a guy that's worked for an antenna department for 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship. And after that apprenticeship, his head is filled up with 50 rules of thumb that he has acquired as to what steps in antenna design work and what doesn't work and what do you do next. A whole bunch of rules of thumb. There's probably as many as 50 of them. I tried to give you guys as many of them as I can from time to time on these technets. These rules of thumb, which are not taught in the schools, but that's the real useful information as to how to design, build, test, and evaluate antennas. A bunch of rules of thumb, and most of those are not in the respective books. Guys acquire it by way of apprenticeship. There's got to be a better way of teaching that. Antennas are extremely valuable. We really need them. We need people who know how to build, test, and design them. I'm off on a tangent here. So it isn't free energy there, John. KC2WGB, we're not doing magic. We're doing something real. You got it, John. KGRIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, I'm sure he has enough information now. Yeah, he's a high school student, junior, and he was having this discussion with his instructor, and he told him about what he heard on the radio, and he said, that's nonsense, can't be. So now he at least has a method of trying to explain it to him. And if you can just remember that it's a resonant cavity, and that it's summing the effect, he can prove his point, and knowing that, you know, it's not something that you can draw for any length of time. So I think it's a perfect answer. I hope it does him well. Let me drop, and I'll go on to one more question.
Hey, it's your Jay with a final comment.
Yeah, he's got to accept the fact that teaching his professor this is not going to be easy. It's not going to be accepted immediately. I'll wait for the beeps and go ahead, Eric.
Now, I think one of the things that we failed to mention is that a high PSWR, why you can put, in your example, why you can put the meter there, is that energy is not getting launched, or that antenna is not resonant. That energy is doing nothing, it's going back and forth. The fact that it's not getting launched means it's not getting drained off, therefore you see the higher wattage.
That's another good way of looking at it, Eric. There's lots of ways of looking at this. Resonators in general in the radio world are a little bit magic. A hell of a lot of the circuits we build. Interstage coupling coefficients, coupling factors, interstage filters and impedance matchers, the quarter wave impedance matcher that Howie was discussing. A quarter wave of coax cable of the right impedance can do some real magic of matching impedance A to impedance B. And sometimes you make the quarter wave coax cable a little longer or a little shorter in order to correct for reactance that's in the system. It's not a pure resistive mismatch. So transmission lines properly used as quarter wave matching sections or stub tuners with a T connector. You put a short circuit or an open circuit piece of coax cable off in one direction. That can be an extremely high power inductor or capacitor that can do a tremendous amount of correcting of impedance mismatches on your transmission line. Sometimes very simple circuits can tolerate very high amounts of power and very little insertion loss, are not very expensive, and they can provide magic once you learn some of the tricks of what you can do with a Smith chart and a transmission line, so to speak, or with the right computer program that does the same thing. Give us the next one, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, another thing too, Dick, if you use a directional coupler and couple that up with a power meter, as long as that SWR is bouncing around, you're going to read it on a steady state. So it is really there. So, you know, that's another thing you could bring up. All right, I'll let it drop and go on to the next one. Quick one.
It's really there until you try to drain it at that power level. Can't do that very long. Any capacitor that's got a whole lot of energy, you can dissipate it. You can drain it away in a hurry. For a short period of time, you can get some huge amounts of energy out of a capacitor, for instance. Over to you, John.
Very good. Okay, the next question is density of water. All right. Now, we take a cubic inch of water, let's say a depth of 5 feet. It has a density. Okay, whatever it is. Now, we take that same amount of water, and we bring it down to 1,000 feet. Now, we know that liquids basically are not compressible, but let's make one thing clear. There's no turbidity, and there's no air entrainment, no gas entrainment, so there's nothing to compress. Like your opinion on what you think about increasing the density of, say, seawater by compression. Is that possible? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
To some degree, everything is compressible. Everything has a property called Young's modulus. In other words, if I apply this amount of force, I will deflect it this amount. Maybe it's only 10 parts per million, so to speak, but everything is compressible to some degree. For all practical purposes, you can consider water as an incompressible fluid, and 99% of the time you're accurate. However, if somebody asked me, can I compress a block of steel? Would say, not really. Well, if you take a look at the explosive technique of all of your 36 or whatever it is shaped charges that are around the perimeter of the spherical object that you and I call an atomic bomb, and when you explode all of those pyrotechnics with exactly the right timing and exactly the right shape, you take that chunk of uranium or plutonium that's in the center, and the tamper that's on the outside, all of that gets compressed. You can compress steel, you can compress uranium, you can compress anything if you apply enough force. You put any of these substances inside of a black hole, and they're going to get compressed. Let me drop it. Now your question is, how much force am I willing to use? I mean, I can take chunks of carbon with the right kind of an anvil-like structure, where I produce millions of pounds of force, and I, in some cases, can compress that carbon and make a very tiny diamond out of it, if you know what I mean. To some degree, everything is compressible. A will admit that water is a very difficult material. Steel and water are very difficult materials to compress. At the bottom of the Mariana Trench, at the 31,000 foot depth in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, is that water down there a cubic centimeter of that, or a cubic inch of it, more dense? Absolutely. Is it twice the density? I doubt it. Is it 10% more dense? Maybe. But you and I could read the Young's modulus, the compressibility of any substance, and find out for how much force I apply, how much am I going to change its dimensions, its volume. To some degree, everything is compressible. And in theory, things are compressible down to a dot, because lots of people want to believe just before the Big Bang, all of this material of the whole damn universe. Let me drop it. They want to believe that all the material of the Don universe was one small dot at one time. I'm skeptical about that. I'll admit it's a hell of a lot more dense. So, to some degree, everything is compressible. The craziness about water is that if you go down to 4 degrees centigrade, water has the highest density without changing the pressure. And then as you go colder than that, it starts expanding again. If it didn't have that crazy property, ice wouldn't float on the top of a lake when it's frozen, and the fish at the bottom wouldn't survive, and life on this planet would be very different. Water's a very magic stuff. And those water molecules in that glass of water sitting on your table right now, those water molecules are moving an average of 600 meters per second. The average speed of those individual water molecules. That is a crazy number. That's almost twice the speed of sound, so to speak, in air. Those water molecules are moving that fast. That gives you a little bit of feeling for why Brownian motion takes place. You think that glass of water is completely steady and not moving. You put one little drop of dark coloring fluid in the top of the water, and in a rather short period of time, it gets thoroughly dissipated around that glass. Assuming the drop of colored material has the same density as the water, it will eventually be completely spread out through that volume of water because of the motion of those molecules. It's a very handy substance as to what it does with biological materials. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Keep your faith in water. Check out, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Okay, we can go over to Paul and let's hear what the space people are doing out there. All those crazy creatures that he talks to. And that's it from the Mailbag. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
I better warn you guys that not everything here on the TechNet is 100% accurate. Thank goodness this material does get peer-reviewed, so to speak, by way of the K1FJM, the other one, KC2NJI, by way of Mike Number One's website. All the TechNets get reported. A fair number of people listen to those recordings, and when they find errors, they let John and I and Paul know about it, and we usually get a chance to correct them, so nobody bats a thousand. Every realistic engineer knows no matter how hard he tries, he's going to have a certain error rate. And a realistic engineer will laugh at himself and say, yeah, I goofed on this one. And you profit from it and go forward. It's the kind of engineer we've all met, kind of a human being that we've all met, kind of physician we've all met, who will never admit he has ever made a mistake. That's not a realistic person. That's going to be a very frustrated person. We're all going to make a certain amount of errors. We gotta try not to do that and laugh at it when it occurs and go forward and say, I'm going to do it better next time. But there's a guy out there in Ronkonkoma that very rarely makes mistakes when he tells us, when he's telling us about space, his favorite passionate subject. He's only been studying space for at least 30 years, that I believe. Paul WS2N is going to tell us the latest things going on in space. Go right ahead, Paul. K2IW in the TechNet. Here comes space report number 210, I believe. You got it, Paul.
Good evening, John. Good evening, Dick. This is WS2N, Space Report. If it wasn't for the mistakes, I would have never learned anything. I agree with that, Dick. That's the best way to learn. The Space Report tonight, not too often do I get to have breaking news, but we have breaking news for the Falcon 9. Is going to take off tonight after the net. It's going to be bringing cargo up to the International Space Station. They call it CRS number 9, the ninth paid trip to SpaceX to do this, and they have the Falcon 9 on launch pad at Launch Complex 40. Right?